And I'm going to sing something, and you're going to do what comes naturally, okay? So, it's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. Okay, very good, thank you. I was seeing some disturbing body language, and I wanted to make sure you remembered who I was and where
as,
I was from.
As a point of personal privilege, as someone who is executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force when that song came out, it's wonderful to see the culture shift at the YMCA.
You see, we do have a new logo as well. We actually are no longer the YMCA. We are now the Y. So some of you may have heard about that. But I just wanted to get us moving and get a little energy in the room here. I have a little disclaimer, just like Dr. Vogt did at the beginning. And the disclaimer is that I don't come to this panel or this conversation as a public health guy, which is kind of unusual to be here at this conference. My background is in working in and with community-based nonprofit organizations, as a program person, as someone who has funded community-based organizations, as a lawyer who represented them, and now as an executive of one of the largest community-based organizations, the Y. So I bring an admittedly different and hopefully useful perspective and set of experiences to this subject of health reform. So it seems to me that there seems to be a consensus now that community-based organizations can play an important role in, I'll call it the policy systems, environmental change, the healthy communities work, and also in spreading chronic disease prevention programs. The CPPW funds themselves, as well as the new community transformation grants, specifically enumerate community-based organizations should be a part of those processes. So there's really not much need here for me today to stand up and make the case to you all about the value of community-based organizations. Instead, as someone who for the past 6 years has been intimately involved with the Y and its own Healthier Communities efforts, which we now have 160 community Healthier Communities efforts around the country, just like the ones that were described here, but in 160 different communities, and more recently, we have launched a diabetes prevention program, as well as other chronic disease prevention programs that I'll share more about. I want to share with you what I've come to learn and what I think others have said to me are some of the value-added things that community-based organizations bring to the table. And so for you all who are trying to do this work, my hope is that for those of you who have maybe not thought of community-based organizations or who are already involved in them, give you some different angles to think about their value. The way I've organized my thinking around this topic is through two groups of slides. The first group is about the value that I think community-based organizations generally bring to the table for healthy communities and chronic disease prevention work. And then my second group of slides are focused on a particular species of community-based organizations, and that's the nationally networked community-based organization and what I think they bring to the table in this work. So as I do this, I'm reminded of the great philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. He once said, "Seek simplicity and distrust it." So this is an effort to simplify. There are clearly examples where my example would not work. So what is the added value that community-based organizations bring to advancing healthier communities in chronic disease prevention programs? The first thing I'd say is they're the arms and legs and pulse of the community. As you think about spreading chronic disease prevention programs through outside the clinical setting, community-based organizations is where people live. They're accessible, they're convenient, they're bricks and mortar locations that people can actually go to. One of the things I've learned in my work with the Y, we're also doing some cancer survivorship programs. And one of the things people most often tell us, the reason people love coming to the program, not just because they like the program, but it's they're not going to a healthcare setting to be engaged in physical activity. Going to the Y is uplifting. Going to the hospital is depressing. And when you've lived and you've come out of chemotherapy and stuff like that, you want to be in a place that uplifts you. And so community-based organizations are where the people are. When you think of them from a healthier communities or a policy systems change standpoint, I think, again, they are where the people are in the sense that many of those community-based organizations have a sense and feel of what's already happening in those communities. Sometimes that's a bad thing in the sense that there's turf wars, but if you really kind of want to know what's already developing, those community-based organizations represent real intelligence, I think, on the ground about what's already happening. I think another thing that community-based organizations bring to the table is trust. And I think the trust is born out of the fact that most community-based organizations are nonprofit, and they're born for the very purpose of serving a community need. They're not there for, you know, pecuniary gain and to make a profit. And in a recent survey, this was done of 1,000 people just before the November elections, a survey was done where 71% of Americans said they trusted nonprofits more than they trusted government or industry to address the most pressing concerns of the day. People identify with community-based organizations, and that's a real asset that you can use in your efforts to advocate or to change the culture. Oh, we have a different set of slides this time. This is fascinating. So this was the one I wanted to show last time, but I was ready to not do it this time. Anyway, this is from a couple of years ago, which just shows, this was in Indiana, a survey of Indiana residents, and it showed trust in nonprofits versus business, local government, state government, and federal government. And what you can see is the blue there is, you know, who do you trust? Some of the time, most of the time, almost always. And you can see there is an inherent trust, again, I think, born of their community mission in community-based organizations. Okay, that trust, I think, is also comes from this notion of bipartisanship, transpolitical, and apolitical. And what we were joking about before is I was trying to think of a term to describe what I think this means, transpolitical, and I went into Wikipedia, and I put in transpolitical, assuming there was a word, and there's no word. But if you, I didn't share this in the last session, but if you keep Googling, you know, you go to the O, you know, in Google, and you start seeing the later hits, it starts to get into more gay, lesbian, transgender things. So I think this is a good word, but I'm just telling you, it may be more loaded than I realize. But anyway, the point is that nonprofits and community-based organizations are often not identified with any one political party. They're not identified with any political ideology. And from that standpoint, there's a sustainability that is refreshing. So in the example that was given earlier, when the health department really wants to go in a certain direction, but the governor doesn't believe in that or doesn't want to put a name on that, the community-based organization can really rally and can be kind of a stalking horse for some of the things that you might want to get done that you can't get done. I think community-based organizations bring power. And I say that because power comes in a lot of ways. They have the ability to advocate. So they can mobilize lots of people. They have mailing lists, right? You're probably on lots of them because they ask you for donations and contributions. But that same database can be used to say, our organization cares about health, and we need to get out tonight at the city council. And they can reach people. Community-based organizations, though, can do more than that. They can actually lobby. Now, they can't lobby with governmental funds, but they can lobby with organizational funds, which means they can go much farther than most any of you can. They can go in and they can talk to the legislator, they can advocate for specific bills, they can talk about specific language, they can propose specific language, they can get all their friends out to stand in front of the state house, etc. And that's a very powerful thing, particularly when you think about the healthy communities work, where much of what you're advocating for around policy is big P policy that really does require advocacy, mobilization, and also lobbying. Community-based organizations also, can also raise funds from multiple sources. I don't know many private foundations who make grants to the government, nor do I know of many foundations that make grants to corporations, right? When you look at their grant guidelines, if you ask the California Endowment, do you fund the government, they'll probably say no. Most private foundations don't. And so by involving the community-based organization, you create an opportunity to raise revenue from sources that you might not easily garner. In our work with Healthier Communities, the 160 communities I was describing with the Y, we've been able to leverage, for every $1, leverage $3.60. So for $10 million of investment, we've leveraged $36 million. And that's pretty good. And that's ultimately going to help sustain these efforts. Community-based organizations also have power through the way they're governed. How many of you are on a charitable or nonprofit board? Yeah, absolutely. And you sit around the table with the bank president and the chamber person and somebody else. But these are all people who, in their day job, might not be able to advocate or do something, but when they wear the hat of your organization, they can do other things. And so this represents a reservoir of power that not many nonprofits, frankly, used as strongly as they could. But you can get them to write letters. You know, one letter from that influential board member can mean more than 100 people on the State House steps. So we can tap into those kinds of things. Community-based organizations also have relationships across multiple sectors and are very familiar with working across sectors. My experience has been government tends to talk to government, private sector tends to talk to private sector, and community-based organizations tend to talk to both. And why? It's for very selfish reasons. Their very existence depends on their ability to raise funds and be connected across multiple sectors. So community-based organizations can bring relationships that maybe folks in government, folks in the private sector don't have, and can be kind of a relationship builder to accomplish larger goals. Flexible and nimble. It's been my experience that community-based organizations are much less bureaucratic than other institutions. They can spend money quickly with accountability, and most importantly, they can buy food. How many of you have gone to meetings where you cannot have food? At noon, at dinner time, I go down to the CDC and they send me the email in advance to remind me to bring my $8 to go into the cafeteria. I'm being sort of silly about this, but at the same time, I'm serious, because I think community-based organizations can bring a spirit of hospitality. And that hospitality matters when it comes to building relationships. You know, special things happen when food is involved. You know, there's a reason we have Thanksgiving dinner. We don't just sit there and talk. We actually have a meal together. So community-based, or this is kind of goes to their nimbleness and flexibility. There's just more room to wiggle. And that, I think, can work sometimes useful ways and maybe unsurprising ways. There's also a culture of entrepreneurship among community-based organizations, the scrappy factor. There's lots of examples I could share with you of, you know, the community-based organization that hears about a grant that, you know, seemingly there's no way they could get, and then they just are so scrappy because their very existence depends on it that they figure out who on their board can get this person and that person, and then they got to buy the land, and they figure out who has the land, and then they figure... It's like incredible how they can kind of be creative and nimble and scrappy, because again, their very existence depends on their flexibility, nimbleness, and entrepreneurship. I think also community-based organizations can be great laboratories for translating projects that many of you are involved in. Government tends to do things categorically. That's by definition, they kind of have to. You have to impact all the same people with a certain criteria and the like, and that lends itself to larger scale kinds of projects. But community-based organizations can, you can try things. You can do things small and kind of see what happens, see how they mature, see how they develop. This has been a very important dimension to the YMCA's diabetes prevention program, which I'll talk a little bit more about. But basically, in the late 90s, NIH proved, a major NIH study proved that the diabetes prevention program could be offered and actually get a better risk reduction of converting to diabetes than a drug metformin. And when that was published in 2002 in the New England Journal of Medicine, everyone cheered. Prevention people cheered. This is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Finally, there's proof that prevention is better. And what happened? Nothing. Because it was too expensive. It cost $1,400 to offer the diabetes prevention program. Well, 3 years later, the YMCA of Indianapolis took the exact same program, got the exact same results for about $300 per person. And it then became scalable. And I'll describe kind of how we're scaling that in just a minute. But that was that notion of trying something small and seeing what happens. And then lastly, cost effectiveness. To do healthy communities work, there's a lot of community-based organizations who have staff who kind of do this already. They may not say, hey, I'm the healthy communities guy or gal, but they're probably someone who's already networking in the community, who's already doing a lot of this kind of stuff, that it's kind of, they wake up in the morning doing this anyway. So there's capacity there to tap into, because that's what their job is anyway. It's not like you have to, in Dr. Vogt's example, you got to pull the epidemiologist now off the epidemiology job, whatever the heck, I don't even know what those people do. And then, you know, we got people running around the community already. So just let's put this into their job, and let's tap into that. And then lastly, on the chronic disease prevention work, again, the reason the Y was able to take a $1,400 program down to $300 a person is because the people who offer this program are not highly credentialed individuals. They're skilled, they're well-trained, but they're like good old-fashioned YMCA people who just, you know, maybe have a bachelor's degree in health and wellness, maybe it was a camping, someone who grew up and became a leader of camping. These folks can do the work at a fraction of the cost. So, my next group of slides is about this special species of community-based organizations, the nationally networked. What do they bring to the table? Well, they bring all the advantages that I just described. They also provide a single point of entry. So if you're trying to do something regionally, you're trying to do something nationally, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense for you guys to try to figure out every YMCA or every Boys and Girls Club, or just call the national organization and we can rally our troops, and you have one phone call. Reach. Okay, how many of you, raise your hand if you live within 3 miles of a YMCA? All right, that's pretty good. About 57% of the US households are located within 3 miles of a YMCA. So when you talk about scaling a national program, organizations like the Y have reach in communities already and can mobilize them. Now, of those of you who raised your hand, raise your hand if you know a relatively senior leader at your YMCA. Shame on you and shame on the Y. Okay? Everybody's hand should be up. Because we're in communities and we are doing more and more in public health. We're still not as far along as we want to be. But you guys need to know that you should call that local Y, or you should call me. And that local Y should be a willing person to take your phone call, because this is absolutely the work that they should be doing, and they know that. Okay, the other reason that that nationally network-based organizations are useful is because they have infrastructure and systems to scale things up. We have training systems, we have training centers, the Y all over the country. We can communicate with all of our staff. We can share knowledge, so everyone's always trying to figure out how do we take what happened in Colorado and translate it to Minnesota. Well, if it's the Y, there's systems of communication and knowledge sharing already inherent in those. So those 160 communities have opportunities to share. This shows you a map of all our 160-plus communities that are doing the policy systems and environmental change work already. This is just an alphabetical listing by state, starting in Alabama to Iowa to Kansas to North Carolina to North Dakota to Wisconsin. Diabetes prevention program. How many of you have heard about what's happening around this program? So we're not doing a very good job communicating. We launched this in Indianapolis, then in 2009 we spread it to Louisville, Kentucky, then in 2010 we spread it to the YMCA of Delaware. What's totally paradigm busting about this program is that we have a third party payer who is reimbursing the Y for participants in the program. So they're reimbursing for prevention. They're reimbursing a non-clinical person, meaning they're reimbursing a community-based organization, the Y. They're reimbursing for a group-based prevention program. Now that's pretty radical. And they're doing it on a performance basis. So if the YMCA doesn't get people to lose weight among people who are pre-diabetic, because that's the essential key thing to help prevent them from getting diabetes, the provider, in our case the Y, doesn't get paid. If the Y gets great weight loss, the Y gets paid. And if the Y gets even greater weight loss, the Y gets paid more. So everyone's interests are aligned. I think this is the direction healthcare is going, and we are very excited to be part of it. And just to show you how scalable this is, since July, basically the last 4 months, we've gone to those two YMCAs to these. We now have programs up and running in every one of these places. Some of them funded by CDC, some of them funded by the private sector, and we will be in hundreds of communities within 2 years. So it is scalable. We can leverage money. I'm going to just skip through this because I want to make sure we have time for questions. We also can roll up data. So One of the challenges of healthy communities work is it's really hard to measure. One of the powerful things about this kind of work, it is a program, but it's scalable. So it is, I think, a systems change. We have a third-party payer paying for it. In that sense, it's a systems change. At the push of a button, I will be able to tell Dr. Co how much weight loss has been had across all of the country in every YMCA. We have built the systems to enable that kind of data aggregation to happen. I'm going to close with this. This is a poem. This is just an excerpt from a poem from Marge Percy. The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shadows and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives in that element, the black sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. You are those people, and I submit to you there are lots of community-based organizations with people just like that running around, and I hope you won't forget about them. Thank you.
So we have time for some discussion, so if you have comments or questions, please come up to the microphone and identify whether you are an ox or a water buffalo. Ellen.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Margaret Walkover, and I'm the Director of Wellness, Recovery, and Resiliency in a 300-
Northern California. So I come from the public mental health part of public health, and I'm realizing being here that it's kind of off in the corner, even though, as I understand it, the national health care reform is going to be an onslaught of Medicaid folks, so more people with mental health and substance abuse issues, we need to be able to provide them effective supports. So my question for you is, in your worlds, how have you begun to consider healthcare homes and the integration of primary and behavioral health care in those healthcare homes? In my county, 85% of the county's contracted out to CBOs, and they're just starting to think about it. And we know from the mental health side, people with severe challenges, that the best services to support are those alternative services support, the self-help, and the mental health and promotion. So what would be exactly people come up for you guys? Yes.
Well, it should be coming up, and I'll let the others answer, but as part of the spending for the Prevention and Public Health Fund, there is going to be, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, $20 million this year, $30 million next year, around integration of community mental health and community clinical care services. So there is certainly a significant investment in that regard. Pardon? It's part of the spending for the Prevention and Public Health Fund. But I'll let.
As part of our health reform, we did, and I'm delighted to hear you call them healthcare homes versus medical homes. I think we're medicalizing too much. So healthcare homes is our medical home. In it, for certification, which is run through the Public Health Department, certification requires they show linkage to community resources, and they have to have consumers on their quality improvement committee. And our certification process involves, I require patients, consumers to be certifiers so that people get designated as a healthcare home. The other thing that's happening in our community is ICSI, the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement. I used to be a past president, so full disclosure. They are working on the DIAMOND Project, Depression Improvement Across Minnesota, offering a new direction, in which they are embedding depression treatment and screening within clinics. And in fact, we now have measurement of PHQ-9 as a measure, so a true outcome. And we have employers and the state rewarding clinics based on those outcomes. So we're trying to integrate it. It's a huge effort, but it is so, so important. So thank you for asking.
Thank you. Next.
Good afternoon. Bruce Gray. New York City has a good model for getting rid of crime. In other words, the city of Baton Rouge adopted it and other states trying to adopt it. Well, with that thought in mind, where you already have progressive efforts already being proven, how would you suggest one adopted for the Delta part of Mississippi? That's what I'm interested in. I hear things that are already being done. So instead of reinventing the wheel, I'd like to see if I can adopt it for Washington, Sunflower, Broward County, instead of Mississippi. I'll be on the website and a contact person I can talk to about the web and the telephone.
This may actually be more done by City and County of Denver than Tri-County Health Department. But I can get you a contact person there if you see me afterwards, and we can link you up.
And I should also add, because it's directly relevant to your question, that the authorization for the community transformation grants essentially is going to result in three types of grants. Because one of the things that we saw with the communities putting prevention to work is that it went to communities that already knew how to do this work and were already up to speed because it was stimulus money and had to be spent quickly. There are going to be three types of grants. There's going to be grants going to innovators, so to try out new approaches. There are going to be grants going to those who already know how to do this work and have the coalitions up and running. But there are also going to be capacity building grants so that communities such as yours, where you need the resources to build the coalitions to begin to do this work and to get the technical assistance to come up to speed so that you can do it, will also be available, because if we don't do it that way, then the divide, the disparity, the geographic disparities become greater and greater. Next.
Good afternoon, Claude Jacob, Service Staff Officer for the City of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and newly elected to the Board of NATO. So I have a question for the first presenter. We heard this morning from our State Health Officer, and we are in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We are a very decentralized state in terms of our public health infrastructure. So I was just wondering from your vantage point, and I appreciate hearing the anecdotes and your effectiveness with the SHIP in Minnesota, and I'm just wondering, given the way that we're configured in Massachusetts, if you have a suggestion or two about how we can effectively continue to push this messaging across our Commonwealth. So that's one question. And as a commercial, and I'm thinking about the why, just wanted to add to your list, because you might not be aware, in Cambridge, we just completed a three-year demonstration project working through a community-based organization, Settlement House, along with my health department and the local YMCA. So that why allowed us to push out a model having to do with reaching diabetic and hypertensive men of color in and around Cambridge. And so it might not show up on your radar as a CDC-funded initiative, but the funding came through, again, through the Office of Minority Health, through the CBL to us, and then it allowed us to do the work. So just a commercial.
And try not to have any more people line up because we're already going over time.
So in thinking about how the state and the locals work together or how locals carry on?
How decentralized is the Minnesota system?
Yeah, Minnesota is pretty decentralized. Yeah, so we are, I think everything that we did, we've done through local health departments and community health boards. So that's how we're doing exactly what Mark was talking about. It's this, Paul Jarrus at ASTO has described it as a public health enterprise. Federal, state, local communities working together, and we're all lining up an architecture to get the greatest results. So with that.
Okay, I really have to stop us in 3 minutes because otherwise you're gonna miss some really good speakers.
Hi, I'm Ashley Belden, and I'm finishing an MPH at San Francisco State University, and I work in the health and wellness industry. And my takeaway from this, and I wanted to kind of bounce this thought off of you guys, is it seems like we have to convince policymakers with language that's about like risk reduction and health and disease prevention, but that isn't sexy or appealing to the population at all. Like, I don't want to just exercise because it's good. I'm going to exercise because feels amazing, it's fun. And so I'm noticing the importance of framing it differently for the different audiences and making sure that it's not the policy-oriented people who are creating the campaigns to get the public moving.
Right, and I think that's an incredibly good point, and it's not, you know, it's not just the public. Policymakers don't get this health. I mean, I think it was the example of not calling it health promotion, but calling it health improvement. We have to be willing to use different language than we have in others, than we traditionally do when we talk among ourselves so we can reach policymakers.
My name is Ron Hale. I work with the Mexico Department of Health, and I work with health councils, community health councils, which represent a different kind of model, not CBOs, not government, but non-categorical community-based coalitions that work in health. I guess my question is, we've just elected a governor in Mexico who is, as many of the other governors who have been elected recently, not particularly supportive of health reform. And it seems to me that the complexity of the law allows for opportunities to settle the problem. And you have referred to this as a mandated funding stream. And I guess I'm just wondering how mandated is it, and is there, should we worry about that?
Well, we always worry, and as was pointed out, we had a challenge to this prevention fund early on, and we may see it again, but I think as the money starts flowing As state and local health departments and community-based organizations receive this money, the political base of support for it will grow. Interestingly, even the governors who say they don't want to implement the insurance side of it are not telling their state health departments not to apply for the new federal money that is available. So it is, you know, it is mandatory as long as Congress doesn't repeal that part of the law, and so far we've been successful in fighting that off. It is separate from the issues around whether the governors are going to slow walk or undermine in some way the implementation of the insurance provisions.
And it's authorized and only in some cases appropriated.
The money for the Prevention of Public Health Fund dollars are an automatic appropriation. So it's just a matter of the agencies, of the Department of Health and Human Services and Congress agreeing on how the money will be spent.
Quick question for the three of you. I'm Sarah Kane from Boise State University, where I direct our Center for the Study of Aging. Wondering your perspective on where do universities fit into the system of implementation?
So, from my standpoint, university, you know, the YMCA doesn't have anybody running around with a PhD after their name.
Microphone.
You know, YMCAs don't have people running around with PhDs after their name, and they have enough trouble putting things into an Excel spreadsheet. So, like, we need academics who can help evaluate things, who can help measure things, who can provide some, you know, quality, credible stuff. And that's what's happened for the diabetes work. The reason our diabetes prevention stuff started getting going and our cancer survivorship is because we always have a university associated with that. And that's been our model, and we're not deviating from that. So put your evaluator hat on, but when you engage with a community-based organization, you got to learn a totally different language, and they need to learn a totally different language too. So it's not always pretty at the beginning. That's my perspective.
For our CPPW grant, academe is actually involved in two areas at the present time. One is with assistance with health impact assessment studies, through contract, and also through students' internships that could actually participate in some of the activities that's ongoing. It's going at light speed, so it's a real opportunity for folks for a three-week rotation.
Okay. Thank you all very much, and please go back to the plenary.